welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking about efforts of differently abled Americans to fight for their rights. We're also going to be talking in a couple of our segments about some of the things swirling around Democratic Party or progressive politics. But before we can move on, I have to be honest with you, listeners. I got to go a little off script today from the talking points. This whole Comey thing has me very worked up. But before I go any further, I have to say very happy celebration here in terms of Chelsea Manning and Oscar Lopez Rivera, who were both released from federal prison today. Great tweet by Chelsea Manning on the way out. Photo of her shoes saying first steps towards freedom. Really, I think a fantastic, fantastic thing moving forward there. 7 years that she was in prison for revealing information that really changed the game on a lot of different levels and how we were perceiving the Iraq war, civilian deaths, the operation of U.S. diplomacy with those cables, dozens of newspapers, all the major newspapers still to this day using the WikiLeaks documents that were given to WikiLeaks by Chelsea Manning for reporting on all sorts of stories and all parts of the world, all parts of the globe for background. And then, of course, Oscar Lopez Rivera, the Puerto Rican liberation fighter who was released from prison as well today. Unbelievable. We see what's happening right now with Puerto Rico. And as we've reported to you before on this show, tens of billions of dollars of debt that was illegally pushed on. Well, I don't want to say pushed on, but illegally presented to and bought by the government there, by all these Wall Street bond traders. Huge austerity coming down on folks. Just a further reaffirmation of the colonial agenda as it concerns Puerto Rico. Of course, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. Many liberation fighters over the years have been imprisoned over their struggle to free Puerto Rico. Que viva Puerto Rico libre, as they say. So Chelsea Manning, Oscar Lopez Rivera, hopefully you're with people who you know and love and celebrating this day. I think those of us listening who are producing this show, myself hosting this show, and many people who are listening to this show, we also are wishing you a great first day out, as it were. So moving forward, though, to this bigger story, which is the Comey thing. The President Trump is asking Comey to back off. Now, there's a whole different range of things on this, but I think it's first worth noting that the New York Times is reporting this information secondhand. Somebody who claims they saw some summary that then they told the New York Times that now is being reported more or less verbatim by the Times. Of course, everyone in Congress using the prefix to everything. If true, this means. The fact that you even have to say that about one of the most major stories, you know, in America today, that you, if true, and here we are reporting it as if it's true. But the most important thing to me is that there's zero context at all to this discussion. Politics is huge in law enforcement. I mean, we could just look at a lower level, Rahm Emanuel covering up the murder of Laquan McDonald to make sure that he can get reelected. I mean, the idea that a top politician would try to get a law enforcement person to do something in relationship to any sort of investigation is not at all shocking. It's not at all novel. And the idea that it did is really just a product of the fact that the media refuses to look at the reality of it. I mean, of course, we have the history of things that have happened. I mean, you can remember President Johnson, who created Operation Chaos, which was the CIA version of COINTELPRO, because he didn't trust J. Edgar Hoover and wanted to make sure that his illegally obtained information on activist groups all across the country was, you know, correct by comparing what the CIA and the FBI were doing. So there you go, right there. I mean, not to mention just the overall fact of who J. Edgar Hoover was as a person and the intense politics that have always been involved in the FBI. I mean, I think many people aren't even fully aware, and we touched on this a little bit earlier in last week with Daniel McAdams about the genesis of the FBI. But if you're going to talk about, oh, well, Trump is, you know, he's politicizing the FBI and he's, in, you know, moving around these investigations, the whole creation of the FBI was political. It was to gain political intelligence on anarchists. And the very first things that they were prosecuting was what we now call the Mann Act. At that time was referred to the White Slavery Act, which, you know, you can go and look that up and look at the history of how this quote-unquote kidnapping law was used really to demonize a number of non-white peoples in America. That is the genesis of the FBI. They gained powers in the Little Red Scare after World War I. They gained more powers after World War II. J. Edgar Hoover used his illegal collection methods to build dossiers on people and exercise his power. I mean, the politics of the FBI is unbelievable. And as for James Comey, because I'm talking about history, but look at the recent history. I mean, not that long ago, most of the press in the United States was condemning James Comey because he was using FBI agents undercover as journalists to try to trick some teenager that they were trying to get in some sting, and they pretended to be an AP journalist, fake websites, fake articles, the whole nine. Everyone was so mad in the media then. James Comey was terrible. Now he's the greatest paragon of whatever, and they're reporting his own handwritten notes told to the New York Times by a friend as if this is some sort of independent verbatim transcript, as if, you know, Dean Backwett is dropping microphones into the Oval Office. The whole thing is completely ridiculous on so many levels. This is someone, James Comey, who said that even Muslim FBI agents should be extra scrutinized because of their religion. Now, we know that white supremacists have killed more people in terrorist acts since 9/11 than Muslims. I'm pretty sure James Comey wasn't saying we need to put extra scrutiny on the white people of Nordic descent inside the FBI. I'm pretty sure that was never happening. This is the same FBI that criminalized the Occupy movement, that was meeting with businesses before things were even happening, telling them protests were violent when they were not violent at all. We can connect that to the Justice Department telling Bank of America to hire political intelligence firms that were designed to create inside, to create online these smear campaigns of individuals to try to gather information on them so that corporations could use that leverage. The criminalization of protest on that level as well. Of course, I already mentioned Muslims in the FBI, the entrapment of the FBI. So people just need to wake up. I mean, the politics of the FBI, the president telling the FBI or the CIA or the NSA to do something that is basically par for the course in Washington. These agencies themselves acting highly politically to protect themselves is par for the course in Washington. Don't forget, it was the CIA that actually withheld from George Bush the full extent of the torture program because they knew he would be against it. I mean, this is just the way things work in Washington. The intelligence agencies are political. The politicians obviously have their own agenda that they're pushing on them, and the push and pull between these different factors and forces play out in any sort of investigation. So some idea that we're in some sort of crazy affront for democracy means that there is absolutely no context to what is going on inside of the country right now. And even in and of itself, it speaks to the unbelievable, you know, underlying premise of a lot of this, that there is some sort of perfectly functioning democracy that was – everything was cool, and then Donald Trump showed up and started tearing it down and burning it to the ground. But, I mean, I'm thinking – especially of thinking of the stories we've reported on this show of the opioid epidemic. And you think about the people in Charleston, West Virginia, the people in Bellingham, Washington, who have had to take on with their own taxpayer dollars suits against these major pharmaceutical companies, some of whom have been fined, by the way, for this behavior, who deceptively marketed opioids that they knew to be highly addictive as not that addictive to addict more people, that pumped millions of pills into pharmacies in many of these areas, even when their own investigators were telling them, do not do this, who possibly, I think, and we'll see this in the Washington State lawsuit revealed, were operating a kickback scheme with pharmaceutical benefits managers in these large chains, Walgreens, CVS, and the like, to also get more things in there. And then when the DEA in 2013 gets relatively close and finds out, wait a second, unlike what Jeff Sessions is saying, it's not Mexicans, you know, sneaking stuff across the border. What did Steve King say, that they're having it sewn into their calves? That's not the cause of the heroin epidemic, that it was the big pharmaceutical companies. What does Eric Holder do? Does he say, yeah, let's go after those big pharmaceutical companies that are pumping these pills into these parts of America? Nope, he tells the DEA, back off. Leave it alone. Don't touch it. Well, where was the democracy for those people when their elected officials just completely abrogated their duties in order to satisfy the needs of the pharmaceutical industry? And this is something we see day in and day out on issue after issue after issue. The moneyed interests have the biggest influence in what goes on in American politics. They pervert it, they move it, they push it, they pull it. And now all of a sudden there is a self-interested campaign that is up there that is fully designed to try to hurt President Donald Trump. And obviously, we're highly critical of him on this show. But it's highly cynical for there to be this whole new thing that he's some unusual threat to democracy when many of these problems were things that existed before, when the past three or four presidents have also aggregated to themselves tremendous imperial powers in terms of what they're doing and the laws they were willing to cross and so on and so forth. I mean, this is not a new problem. This is not a Republican problem. It's not a Donald Trump problem. It's a part of the nature of the system. And we said it so many times, but I just have to lay it out there again in terms of the logical realities of what's happening. You had the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, who had been highly criticized over the past few years for a number of the things that they'd started to do. You started to have reforms that were happening after the Snowden leaks and a lot of these things. Now, all of a sudden, all of these intelligence agencies that were committing rampantly unconstitutional behavior that more or less everyone was starting to agree probably needed to be reined in some way, shape, or form, all look like sweetness and light and defenders of democracy. And it just seems highly coincidental that they are being held up on a pedestal, and organizations like WikiLeaks and others that have revealed these things are now being completely torn down. I think it's highly convenient that this is the way that it's playing out. I think people need to think about the nature of that. And I think we also have to reflect on the fact that Democrats supercharging this over and above the Kris Kobach issue on voter suppression. If every single thing that's said about Russia is 100% true, if everything was 100% true, the voter suppression was worse. It was worse. But they're not talking about that. They're talking about Russia. We could go on and on. We could talk about this all day. I just had to go a little bit off of our normal talking points script because I just think that this whole thing is starting to become completely out of control on so many different levels. So those are our modified talking points. I guess we can say that. One extended talking point about this continuing thing. And we'll keep reporting to you, you know, about everything that is going on here. But you are still listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm still your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to be continuing our conversation with Anoa Chango, who's a lawyer and the host of The Way with Anoa. Anoa, obviously the big, I don't know if you can call it news, but the ongoing controversy where just new little things seem to keep happening is this James Comey Trump Russia investigation saga. And now everyone is very upset that they feel that Donald Trump has, according to a memo that somebody saw, who then told the New York Times what it said. James Comey's readout of the conversation with Donald Trump was that Trump asked him to stop the investigation into Flynn. People are saying that's obstruction of justice. It may be. It may not be. But I think the point of it is, I don't know how you're seeing this, but it just seems like we're putting so much focus on this one issue and almost no focus on any other issue. I mean, you had Jeff Sessions going back to the drug war. You had Kris Kobach being appointed to the voter suppression thing. I mean, what are we doing here?
I feel like we are playing this really insipid game of middle school telephone, just to go back to just the one part you mentioned about someone saw something, who told someone, who reported something, who told the New York. Like at what point do we start looking at how insane, you know, all of this is? Okay, yes, so we do actually need people to alert when there could be potential malfeasance and other issues going on, particularly with our government elected officials. That's crucial. We just saw Chelsea Manning is a free woman as of this morning, right? So there is a necessity for people to be in a whistleblower type of capacity. But I don't even know if that's what's happening here, right? It just seems like there's a lot of gossiping, there's a lot of rumors, there's a lot of things in windows that are being then put out by supposedly, you know, legitimate, you know, revered news outlets with no actual documentation, nothing, just the word of someone who may have, because everyone's so intent on getting a one-up on a story that makes Trump look even more nefarious, corrupt, or stupid than the story before. And I really don't know where we are. But you mentioned two really important issues that have come up in the past week out of this administration. The creation of the Voter Fraud Commission, which has been a blip, been very much overlooked by these mainstream outlets because everyone is being drowned out by Russia. But the story of voter suppression and the fallacy of the threat of voter fraud is huge. It's not just, you know, an undercover story now. it was the undercover story of the 2016 election and the millions of people that cross-check denied access to the ballot box across the country among the different voter ID laws that are now being struck down. We saw several North Carolina laws getting struck down by the Supreme Court. I mean, there's so many. Well, the Supreme Court denied cert upholding the appellate court decision in North Carolina. But we've seen so many issues that are really, really crucial. We talk about threats to our electoral integrity, threats to our democracy. What's happening right now, Trump is an idiot. You know, this will all play itself out. But there are serious threats right now that are not being actively reported and worked on. And it's rather disturbing. In terms of the Comey memos or whatever, I saw that various members of House are requesting that the acting FBI director, you know, release whatever recordings, memos. I mean, if Comey hasn't done that, that clearly was a smart business practice. You know, when you have an erratic boss, I saw someone use this example. If you have a crazy boss, and they're constantly back and forth, you want to make sure you make note of every single interaction you have just in case something happens, you know, so it doesn't come back to bite you. So from that standpoint, it seems like a good practice. Where we are in this, I think there's this frenzied pace and obsession with Trump as this huge failure that we're losing sight of what, you know, the real issues are at stake. I mean, not saying, again, we've talked about this before, about whether or not Russia is a real issue or not. Not even necessarily any indication specifically that Comey has some heightened knowledge of some other stuff with Russia and has been totally construed to be something more than the little we actually even know. And it just seems like people are looking for information to keep a certain spree and narrative going that really undermines a lot of other discussions, topics, and work to be done.
No, I think you're entirely correct. And I mean, it just sort of seems like, I mean, especially the Democrats focusing so much on impeachment. I mean, well, I guess theoretically they could try to introduce articles of impeachment, but it's more or less out of their hands. It's clear that the Speaker of the House is against it. And it just sort of seems that if what they wanted to do was just generally discredit Donald Trump and the general thing, that they would be focused on these other things. And then if some sort of smoking gun or whatever comes out or something that looks terrible, like, I mean, imagine just had they paid very little attention to this over the past like 2 weeks or whatever, or 3, 4, 5 weeks, and then all of a sudden this Comey thing comes out and it's a big deal, then I could see, okay, you jump on that at that moment, like whether, you know, I think it's right or not, I could see that happening. But it just sort of seems like when the power of impeachment is out of your hands, this sort of creation of this sort of, I mean, the media is going to do it for you. So I just don't understand why they feel so wedded to try to create this narrative around the need for impeachment when they know they can't drive it, that it's going to come from the media, it's going to come from people, you know, pushing for that on the grassroots, like with the Bush impeachment, and try to focus on, you know, sort of energizing their base, unless a huge part of this is that they want to cover up why they didn't win in 2016.
Absolutely. Like I said before, you know, we've focused so much on Trump being bad ever since it swung into general election cycle time, you know, last summer, approximately around this time last year. And there was massive, I mean, we knew going into the 2016 election, we knew from 2013 that this was going to be a tough election in terms of voting rights and voter suppression. I mean, you look at the massive amount of laws that were passed right after the Shelby decision in 2013 that, you know, gutted the Voting Rights Act and removed, you know, the removed Section 5. And, you know, we knew North Carolina was going to be issued. North Carolina was issued in the primary, but it was ignored. Democrats ignored, you know, rampant issues of voter integrity during the primary process because it suited them, but they never came back to address it for the general election. It's just, you know, we've seen this happen before, though. We saw this in 2000 in Florida with, you know, Al Gore. There was voter suppression and disenfranchisement that happened to black voters in Florida, but it wasn't a part of the calculus. They gambled, didn't own it, and lost. And you know, Democrats still get this big tent party. This is the care about, you know, protecting the rights of the people and the little people and all this other stuff. But yet, like, this is so crucial and integral to our democracy, right? And it's like, why do Democrats not own the mantle of protecting voter rights and voter suppression? Leaders of the party are mum, right? It's a mere blip. We can have sit-ins for gun rights to get an unconstitutional, to use the no-fly list. We can lay it all in the line for stuff like that, which ultimately is just foul. But where is the real massive uprising about what is happening to the system of access to the ballot box? I mean, we are looking, particularly now with the creation, with the person who is singularly responsible for creating cross-check, for disenfranchising millions of voters nationwide, is now being put in charge of a voter fraud commission on the federal level. Like, it's very clear what is happening here. It's very clear where we're going back to. And where are Democrats on this issue? But hey, Russia and Trump, which again, it's not that it's not, you know, it's very questionable. There are real issues. But at the same time, there is no balance in what is happening right now. Everything is about Russia. Everything is about attempts to influence an election. When we have real, actual disenfranchisement and suppression that happens, that is not being addressed at all. It's a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, parenthetically, is having a bigger effect in terms of what's going on with elections than anything. Even if everything they said about Russia was true, it still wouldn't come close to what the Republicans have done, you know, really starting in the year 2000. One quick thing here, about a minute before our first break. Do you suspect this could help John Ossoff, since I know he's been really pushing that quote-unquote anti-corruption angle in the special election down there in Georgia 6 to replace Tom Price?
I think what is interesting about all this, I mean, it's possible because of the way that Trump has kind of come in and Handel has kind of like embraced being a part of the Trump Republican brand, right? So I think that to some extent it possibly care. But really down here in Georgia, I don't know that people really care as much. The corruption part, yes. Well, people want good representatives who are going to be in office, who are going to represent the people. But I really do think that, you know, I don't know that for anyone anywhere in the country that this Russia stuff is really going to help them get out the vote and really engage people. They just recently won a decision here in Georgia that allowed for extended voter registration because there was a ruling or a law here that actually was deemed impermissible. And so, you know, they were able to get more people registered in time for the special election. And then also, you know, early voting is coming up. So, I mean, I do think that they're really mobilizing to get people turned out. But even talking about that race real quick, there were some issues because there was a special election, I believe it was yesterday, for a state seat in that same district. And there was little to no support given, you know, for that seat. We had the opportunity to turn a state seat blue, and they blew it because no one is focusing, and it's in that same exact district. You know, there's no sharing of resources or there was no really massive effort to have canvas for this woman that was running on the state level. Everyone's just focused on this one seat. And so Democrats are still having a problem with how they're being able to allocate resources and really engage people to get some of these seats back. We need those state seats back just as much as we need Congress, if not more.
Absolutely. Well, certainly we are going to take a break on that. We're going to come back with more here with Anoa Chenga on some of the issues roiling the political sphere on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, and today we started off talking about the new Trump-Russia-Comey drama and how really it's the last thing people should be focusing on if they want to make progressive change. And we continue to be joined here by Anoa Chenga, who's an attorney and the host of The Way with Anoa. And, you know, another issue that I want to get your thoughts on, Anoa, here, since we're talking about candidates and I sort of ended the last thing with the John Ossoff piece. I don't know if you saw this article. I'm sure you probably did, though. The New York Times article about newer black candidates entering gubernatorial races, including Stacey Abrams down there in Georgia, the potential of Ben Jealous in Maryland, Andrew Gilliam in Florida. And, I mean, there were so many things about that article that I thought was actually interesting. It was a well-done article, I thought, by the New York Times. But the number one thing I thought was interesting is that all these people are very popular nationally. They all have shown that they can raise money, which is obviously key when you're running for governor in big states like that. And all of them are almost certainly going to be faced with well-funded white candidates that may end up knocking them out of the primary on, well, look, you live in the South, you know how it is, quote-unquote electability grounds. So your thoughts on that issue, but, I mean, anything else that caught your eye in that piece as well?
Well, I did get a chance to see that piece. Actually, you know, I guess he's not really my boss, but boss man, Marcus Farrell is actually down here working on Stacey Abrams' campaign. And just being here in Georgia, seeing some of the chatter and stuff about her potential candidacy and exploratory, you know, efforts and stuff. What I thought was really interesting, because it was like young black progressives, and it's just really interesting how so many people get back and forth into who's a progressive and who's not progressive. So, I mean, these are not necessarily the most, I guess, progressive, you know, I guess it's that weird terminology. But at the same time, I really do think it's interesting because these are people who maybe once upon a time would have been told it's not your turn, you need to wait, or, you know, the party would have put someone else up. But there are people who are stepping out there and claiming space and not really waiting to see if they're going to get, you know, I think Stacey Abrams will get a lot of support from folks, but I do know there's also a lot of pushback as well. Andrew in Florida, you know, being mayor of Jacksonville, I don't really know what that leap is to go from mayor to governor, but just from watching and seeing, you know, some of the chatter, it's a bold move, and it's definitely, I mean, he definitely has support, but I think that we're in that time. You know, it's no more that, you know, wait your term. That's what they tried to do to Obama in 2008, right? Well, you're young, you know, you still have time. It's not your turn. And we've seen so much of that. It's not your turn and trying to silence and dismiss people. I mean, to some extent, that's what was done with Jesse Jackson's races, right? He wasn't right. It wasn't his turn. It just wasn't for him. And so we've seen, you know, black and to some extent Latino candidates as well in these larger offices kind of get stifled or put off to the side, not really supported in the same way. What I do think they will benefit is if they have the organizing capacity in relationships with voters on the ground. I mean, they might get outspent, but we've seen the opportunity for people, even if they're not raising the same level of money. And I think these are candidates. These are, you know, relatively big name candidates, at least in their circles, where they'll be able to pull in some funds. But I do think that there are also people who are connecting with the ground, with the people, in a way that we'll be able to see some of that Bernie Sanders style grassroots organizing, you know, we're familiar with from the past 2 years. We'll see that trickle in through these campaigns. I definitely think with Ben Jealous in Maryland, there's the potential to really shake things up, same, you know, all these races. It's interesting to see, you know, the work that is being done. I wouldn't be surprised if Jessica Byrd and Democracy in Color have their hands in some of this someplace, because there really is a push for the Democratic Party to not run away from black and Latino voters, but to embrace them, since that is who really delivers and makes up the workforce for many of these major wins, and demanding basically a reckoning. You know, it's no more that, you know, you sit in the corner, it's not your time yet. It's claiming space and not backing down. And I see that trickling up to some extent from the organizing grassroots class to more of the political classes. And so it's definitely going to be an interesting wave of races to watch and see how they play out.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly interesting. I thought it was a good point that Stacey Abrams made in the article about sort of energizing your core support. And to me, it speaks to sort of the trapdoor in the whole impeachment thing in the first place as well, from the point of view of the Democrats, is that, you know, if let's say they do impeach Donald Trump and they get Mike Pence, who certainly is much more or much less rude, I'll say that his policies are probably worse. But I mean, at the very least, he carries himself much more respectfully of other human beings, which just sounds like a crazy thing to even say about someone, but and nevertheless, it certainly makes him better. But then the Republican brand is no longer tarnished. And that's the Republicans sort of get off the hook. It's like, oh, it was just Trump. When it's like, it's all these people. You know, I mean, it's Kris Kobach as the Secretary of State of Kansas, where obviously insane government under Sam Brownback, which has turned a lot of Republicans against their own party. I mean, you know, the Tom Prices of the world who are in HA, he was talking about repealing Obamacare for years. I mean, like, all these people are all complicit in it. They're all, and certainly the voter suppression. Certainly, you know, the police issue. You look at Larry Krasner, the Democrat who won the thing, won by saying, we're going to clean out the DA's office and be on the side of the afflicted and those of the like. But you let the Republicans sort of get someone new in there and renew their brand, you may end up holding a bag that doesn't really do what you want to do. Beyond just getting Trump out there, you may have actually given the Republicans, if somehow Democrats are able to push impeachment, the Republicans a great out of not having this like millstone of Trump around their neck.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that is what continues to happen, because even just watching the town hall last night with Bernie Sanders and John
Kasich,
just even thinking about, you know, the way Kasich, for example, and the few who are, I mean, they did this with, what is his name from Arizona? My mind is totally going blank, old guy from Arizona.
John McCain.
John McCain. See, Johns. I'm blanking today. But anyway, but we see this happening, right? There's this attempt to kind of distance the good Republicans from Trump, and it's like they need to own this. So I do agree with you. Like, if they're somehow able to, because making this all about Trump is really problematic, because that way you're able to isolate Trump as the problem, and then Pence gets to come in like some savior when he's equally, and if not some ways, even more problematic or detrimental. Because let's not get it twisted. The stuff that Trump is doing, yeah, I mean, Pence is more well-mannered and he understands process and procedure, but there's no indication that he would do things differently, and if not, might even go farther in certain areas than Trump has already been able to go. Trump is just a wild madman who's kind of stupid. Well, not kind of stupid, he's rather stupid and out of control. But, you know, do we, the respectability aspect aside of Pence, Pence is very scary. So there is this, there is, whether it's intentional or not, but there is this framing of this as a Trump-only issue and not a ideological problem within the Republican Party that has allowed for someone like Trump to take root the way he has. And we saw this during the campaign with this appeal to the 2016 cycle with Democrats and Hillary Clinton trying to make appeal to moderate or reasonable Republicans. You know, the same thing's happening now in the Georgia 6 race with John Ossoff because of the district that he's in. You know, it's understandable that you want to appeal to voters around you, you know, a wide berth of voters, but at the same time, at what point do you cross that line where you're giving people a way out when they should actually be called in and held accountable? So that is a really interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one other issue, and I raised this Larry Krasner thing because I thought it speaks to another point that I think is also flying under the radar and certainly relevant to Black and Latino communities and you know, how they're going to relate to candidates is, I think, quote-unquote criminal justice reform is being revealed as an underrated issue that people really care about and will come out for. I mean, obviously, I just mentioned the thing about how Krasner is to win, but you think about Bill de Blasio in New York, obviously Kim Fox, I think it was Kim Ogg in Houston, whoever it was, Aramis Ayala. I mean, so many people who are coming on. You know, it might not be everything I would love to see, but clearly more forward-thinking, looking at how we deal with quote-unquote crime, justice, policing, mass incarceration, or whatever, and they're winning on it as a significant issue. And I think that's, like, not a small thing, even though we've seen Democrats nationally have, I think, not really been as willing to embrace the issue, that on the local level, people are winning on this issue.
Agreed. Like, we're seeing, I mean, we just saw the win last night in the Dem primary in Philadelphia, right? Like, it is a total break from what has been the trajectory in terms of dealing with the issue or, you know, the area of criminal justice reform in America. And you know, Eric Holder had a letter, I think, a couple of days ago or last week, whatever, about this change of course so much. It's like about how it's not even smart. Right? I mean, you wouldn't be tough on crime. Like, this is just being stupid. You know, hearkening back to an era that did not work is riddled with not just error, but deprivation of people's rights and access to resources by being mislabeled or put in a system. It completely flies in the face of everything that the country as a whole has been working towards in that area. But at the same time, it's not surprising when you look at what happens when Republicans are in charge in this area. So not to relitigate the election or any of that stuff, but at the same time, like, we really do need to be cognizant and aware of what's happening at the federal level, but it also reinforces a need to be active and engaged and involved on this issue at the state and local level, because more of, like, for example, when everyone's really excited that, you know, oh my God, the DOJ is closing private prisons, ooh, when in fact the majority of the federal government's private holdings are with, you know, Bureau of Customs and Enforcement in terms of detention centers, right? So the large bulk of private prisons, if that's something that you're passionate about addressing, are at the state level. That's a state level issue that's going to have to be, you know, you can have a national coalition of folks who work on it, but people have to come together and work together at the state level for a lot of these issues. And we've lost so much sight of that being caught up on these broader federal issues. Not that we can't have those large coalitions, but we really need to be focusing, you know, backwards on, you know, that local level. You brought up Aramis Ayala's case down in Florida. What is happening is an egregious error on behalf of the governor, Rick Scott, in usurping her authority to actually have a prosecutor use a discretion. So often prosecutorial discretion is a bane of our existence, but this is an instance where prosecutorial discretion is actually being used in a pursuit of justice overall. And it's under attack because we have a black woman exercising her authority to actually level the field in a fair way while still bringing about justice for crimes committed. So we're looking at things that need to really be beefed up and focused on a state level, actually, you know, work that we can do. There's actually ground we can cover outside of focusing solely on Trump and Sessions and those people.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems like to some degree people are maybe more focused on the opponent's uniform than scoring a goal. You know, I mean, if you look at the Republicans, to me, like, that's what this whole, like, when I saw that Kris Kobach thing, the thing that just struck me is that over two decades, the Republicans have really executed a multiple layered strategy that wasn't really about, like, who they were opposing per se, but what they needed to do. Purging of voter rolls, voter ID laws, the gerrymandered districts that come along with sort of tailoring the voting rolls and then starts to reinforce that in the laws that you're able to pass. The push towards pushing on state legislatures to try to get the thing there for the Constitutional Convention, which I think they're only six states away from perhaps being able to amend and change the entire Constitution. And then, you know, all these other pieces. And then, of course, on top of all that, the obstruction strategy on Obama, which they started, like, the day after he was elected, they were like, oh, yeah, let's just do this. And it was like a multi-layered, multi-level strategy on so many things to just get them to the place where they want to be, where the fundamentals were there for them to control both houses of Congress, the presidency, and most state houses. And it's like obviously one sort of unitary ground-up, bottom-to-top strategy, and you don't see the same thing on the progressive side of like, okay, what is the goal we're trying to achieve, and how do we start to push this, not irrespective of who our opponents are, but to some degree, you know, not dependent on having a terrible person like Trump, you know what I mean? Like, they weren't dependent on being able to demonize Obama, but when they got the opportunity, they said, oh, great, we'll supercharge our whole plan.
Well, yeah, Republicans definitely have a better understanding of how to play offense and defense, right? They can play both sides of the field. Democrats, progressives, the left, to some extent, tend to be stuck in the defense-only mode. Every once in a while, maybe trying to advocate for something, but still it's always a defensive position, trying to defend something, trying to protect something, versus moving on the offense. And we really need to diversify our approaches in the way we engage. And now it's kind of hard, particularly when you're smaller, underfunded groups. You know, you've got to have to pick and choose kind of where you are. But we do need, I'm all about cooperative efforts and collaboratives, you know, especially, you know, with both of us working with Congress of Resistance, like, you know, these types of initiatives to bring broader groups of people together to proactively work on things are really crucial more now than ever, because we have seen how just kind of reacting to what Republicans do, reacting to what the right does, you know, we lose ground, we lose seats, we lose rights. Like you just mentioned, even the way the redistricting, the rewriting of the map, the drastic changes that were made in 2010 from previous conversation with Daley, you know, people... It wasn't like they were hiding in the secrets and then in bar committees. I mean, it was very out and open. There were op-eds. Dick Cheney wrote an op-ed about what they were going to do, and then they did it. And it's just like people are like, oh, my God. I mean, Republicans say they're going to do something, and then they follow through. Now, whether they're always successful or not is a whole other story, but we can't just keep hoping for Republican failure. Right? We actually have to be proactive to bring about. So, and not saying that there's no one who's ever been proactive, but we need to have more of a counterbalance between being defensive on these issues and being proactive and actually trying to build something. Because right now, there's still so much reactionary to Trump. How are you, as in these people out there, resistance, whatever you're calling yourselves out there in listening land, how are people actually transitioning from merely resisting Trump or stopping Trump or Trump needs impeached to actually building the coalition, building the work that is necessary to win seats in 2018? And for people who support third-party candidates, what is being done to help build up that base, to help educate people about the alternatives that exist where you are versus just saying how awful the Democrats are and the Republicans and whoever? Like, we got to do more than just point out how bad everything else is. I mean, even the stuff that's going on right now with you know, we have the DNC fraud lawsuit. We also have the erroneous story that came out yesterday about Seth Rich's murder. Like, there are people who hearken in these various spaces, particularly in social media, where they're willing to point out what's wrong, who's corrupt, who's doing this. But that doesn't really help engage the masses who have disengaged from the system. If anything, it proves them right for why they're not involved. But we need to bring people in. We need people to be engaged for a particular reason. And we also need to build those processes and those places for them to feel comfortable to engage, right? So it has to be, you know, yes, we can point out, we can talk about this other stuff. That's fine. But what else are you doing? What are you giving people to vote for? That was our biggest complaint about the Democratic Party, right? They didn't give people anything to vote for. We, as the left, progressives, whoever, however people want to define themselves, can't repeat the same mistakes that we're constantly complaining about Democrats and then wonder why we're not moving the needle any. You know? So I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, it really just is one of those situations where you think people would want to make a more substantive evaluation, but I guess it's difficult to make a more substantive evaluation about what you did wrong when at the root of what you did wrong is the only way you have to make money, really. And I think, like, the influence of not only corporate donors, but and I think the Young Turks have made this point as well, just like the whole sort of consultant, you know, whatever industry that rests at the heart of both of these major political committees, which then ties a lot of these advisors or whatever into some sort of financial, you know, whatever you want to call it, base or something that they have no ability to break from if they don't want to lose their livelihood. And so obviously they can't be truthful and do what's necessary. But nevertheless, you know, many issues here, many things that we'll still discuss, many things that we still will be following. That was Anoa Chenga. She's the host of The Way with Anoa, which I really suggest everyone check out. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to come back with more. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a whole range of actions that are happening in Washington, D.C. this week, led by the disabled community fighting for their rights, really for things that will impact them around the country. And we are very happy to be joined here by Jerry Costley, who's the executive director of the Utah chapter of ADAPT and a member of their Disabled Rights Action Committee. Rhoda Gibson, co-founder of Mass ADAPT, which is the Massachusetts chapter of ADAPT. And Mary Lee Adamski-Smith, who's the chair of the Media Committee for ADAPT. Thank you all so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Oh, of course. It's great to have you in. And, you know, you guys have really caught my eye with some of the mass actions you've been doing here in Washington. And I want to get into some of the legislation and things that you're working on in the Hill. And I know folks have been lobbying today, but I wanted to just start with some of the issues that were raised around the action you all did at the FDA. You were there, you were protesting, and you're trying to get them to basically ban this, some people might call it therapeutic use of electric shock on disabled people on this Judge Rottenberg Center in Massachusetts. I think it's an unbelievable story. It absolutely deserves to be heard here. And so, Rhoda, I'll start with you. If you could just explain to me, what is this Judge Rottenberg Center and what is going on there?
Well, the Judge Rottenberg Center basically takes children, mostly of color, African-American children, and that are physically, but most definitely emotionally, mentally handicapped, disabled. And they try to electric shock them to get that disability out of them so that they will do what they want them to do versus trying to work with them. And unfortunately, as I mentioned, that it is mostly disabled children of color, and the majority of them are from the state of New York. And unfortunately as well, the state of New York pays $200,000 per child to go to this institution that is supposed to be helping them. And it is very sad. We've lost quite a few kids from being electric shocked so much. It needs to be stopped. And this is the only place in the United States that is allowed to do this. The prisoners, the Guantanamo Bay prisoners, are not even being allowed to be electroshocked and tortured. Mm. So why are we letting our disabled children, especially our minority persons of color, children that are disabled, why are we allowed to torture them?
Yeah, I mean, it really is unbelievable story, the use of electric shocks. I mean, it just, I can't even imagine why the FDA wouldn't just ban this right away. And I think it's a relevant issue, Jerry, because you and I were talking a little bit before the show. It's not as if this is the only thing that they could be doing. I mean, this is a choice. There are much better ways that many of these issues could be dealt with. Is that correct?
That is correct. They have families that are desperate. Obviously, you've got children who engage in self-injurious behaviors, headbanging. Those kinds of things, gouging at their eyes, and the parents are desperate. And so they have been sold this idea that this is the last resort, this is the only thing that will work, and they will defend tooth and nail the actions that are happening at the Judge Rottenberg Center. But the scientific research suggests that this is not effective. It does not teach people appropriate behavior. It doesn't teach them what they need to do or how they need to act. It simply traumatizes them, and the behaviors don't go away long term, and many times they don't go away at all, and many times there are other behaviors are added. Let me just give you an example of one alternative. There was a group of individuals who were banging their heads to the point of giving themselves concussions, and they were bleeding. They tried all sorts of aversives. They tried the electric shock. They tried lemon juice in the mouth. They tried squirting them in the face with water. And then they got the idea that when you cause yourself pain, your brain releases natural opioids. And maybe these individuals were actually addicted to their own internal opioids. And so they started administering naltrexone to them. And naltrexone is the same kind of thing you hear about with Narcan, where it will reverse opioid addictions, or not addictions, but opioid overdoses, because it goes into the opioid receptors on the brain, kicks out any opioids, natural or otherwise, and sits on those and doesn't allow the opioids to return. So they gave these injections of this naltrexone, very benign in all other aspects. You don't even notice it. And the headbanging behavior went down to zero. They continued to do that for a while because the individuals were not getting the payoff of the natural opioids. And when they stopped the naltrexone, the behaviors didn't return. And now this has become a standard treatment for the headbanging behavior that Judge Rottenberg will say is that can only be treated or is only can be effectively worked on through the electric shock. Not so. The evidence is not there, and there's no moral justification for it. We don't believe there's a legal justification for it, and there is no scientific justification for it.
Well, I think that it's certainly all, I mean, really unbelievable. And I'd like to think that the FDA will move quickly to do something here, but I think that's something that our listeners should keep a very close eye on. But I don't want to just stay focused fully in the negative, because you guys are trying to push forward and propose some things that are really looking forward. So, Mary Lee, I want to turn to you here, because I was very interested to see this Disability Integration Act that you guys are lobbying for. And so maybe you can just start us off and say a bit about the DIA, Disability Integration Act, and what it's going to do, and we'll go from there.
The Disability Integration Act will allow us to be able to live in the community. It is our constitutional right to be able to live in the community and get the supports and services, just like attending care services and, you know, transportation stuff, and instead of being forced into nursing homes and other institutions. So this will actually strengthen the ADA, and it'll be mandatory where the states will need to follow this law and provide attendant care services and have us be living out in the community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, well, I think that is very, very, very important issue, and I think certainly mirrors a lot of how people have been talking about the importance of community care for a lot of different populations. Jerry, I mean, why is this DIA so important? And I mean, if maybe you could just give some sense of the nature of the reality for many disabled people who, because of resources or because of the lack of legislation, are kind of sort of pushed into institutionalization.
A couple of things on that. For many, many years, the only option was to go into a nursing facility. And the nursing facility has fought very, very hard to maintain that monopoly on our lives. And so if I require assistance, first of all, I have to go in, and the government requires that I show that I need nursing facility level of assistance, which is ridiculous to begin with. Once I prove that I need nursing facility level of assistance in order to survive, then I am given a choice. I can move into a nursing facility today, and the government will immediately start to fund that. Or I can request a small portion of the money that the nursing facility would require to hire my own attendant. If I choose the latter, then I can be put on a waiting list for over 10 years. So I'm told, and sometimes you move backwards on the waiting list because they try and fund people that they feel have more intense needs. So then I'm given this horrible choice of either going to this nursing facility, and we took testimony a while back of some horrific stories, people that were being forced to bathe in fecal matter and urine, people that were being put in tubs of ice. Mm-hmm. And that's at the worst. At the best, facilities that have these large groups of people have to treat you as a collective. And so I can't get up at 2 in the morning and go down to the refrigerator and open up the refrigerator and get a snack. Breakfast is only served during certain times. Lunch is only served during times. The best story we had is we had a woman that was put on what the prison would call lockdown. And they told her she could not leave the facility. And we said, well, why not? And they said, well, because she went out and had a beer over lunch with her friends. And we said, what's the problem with that? Well, some people are on medication, and the medication can have a negative interaction with the alcohol. Is she on any of these medications? And they said, well, we don't know. We don't have the time to look at everyone like that. So we just tell everyone that they can't drink alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that is the kind of, at its best, the way they treat people, and you lose your freedoms and you lose your rights. So the Disability Integration Act simply says, if I qualify for nursing facility level of care, then I can request to have money that I can use to hire attendants with. And that needs to be made available immediately. If I can go into the nursing facility immediately, it then puts the community services on an equal footing with that. Mm. And then I become a true consumer. We have a marketplace, and I think the nursing facilities won't necessarily, all of them won't go out of business, but they're going to be forced to compete for our business. We get to make a decision. And most people want to live in the community, want to live in their own homes and their own apartments and hire attendants. And sometimes the attendants become abusive. Sometimes the attendants are not as effective as they should be. They're not reliable. And I can fire them. I don't have to go to the director of nursing and complain to them and have them go to the administrator and hope that they will do it, knowing that they've got a staff shortage. I simply can fire my people and hire them. And it's a little easier to hire and fire because I get to set my wages. Mm. And I can have higher wages and still cost less than the nursing facility. Just one quick example. Mm-hmm. We had a woman who moved to our state from Denver, and she had attendant care in Denver. And when she moved to Utah, they told her, no, you're going to be on a waiting list. There's 20 people ahead of you on the waiting list. Mm. And you need to go into the nursing facility and be there. And when she was in a nursing facility before, when they felt she was being too demanding of her rights, they would take away her wheelchair and she would have to sit on the floor for 3 days, unable to move while they taught her a lesson, quote unquote. We went in and we took over the governor's office overnight. And in the morning, they said, well, it's not fair that we fund her ahead of the 20 people on the waiting list. We said, that's right. We want all 21 funded. Right. They finally agreed to that. They were upset. They said, never again. But you need to know, this woman required assistance to take a drink of water. She required assistance to eat. She required assistance to go to the bathroom. She required assistance to get up. And sometime after she got her attendance, she got a job. Mm. And the people at her work would help her do those things. Sometime after that, she started a date and fell in love with the young man. Sometime after that, she got married, and he became part of her natural support, so the cost to the state went down even further. Sometime after that, she had 2 children. Mm. And the quality of life you're talking about for a woman who is now married, is now a mother, has children, working, versus sitting in that nursing facility on the floor while somebody teaches her, quote, her place, unquote, is you can't measure them. But for the conservatives, we're not paying for a director of nursing. We're not paying for an administrator. We're not paying for a social worker. We're not paying for a psychologist, all of which you get in the nursing facility. We are paying only for an attendant to come in the morning to get her up, an attendant to meet her when she gets back from work, and an attendant to put her to bed. Mm. And the cost is much, much less.
Mm. Rhoda, please.
I'm one of those persons. I developed a staph infection down my back 6 years ago in October. It will be 6 years in October. And they wanted to put me in a nursing home, and I was told I'd never walk again. I'm an incomplete. I've begun to walk. I live in my own apartment in an accessible, affordable, integrated building that has market rent, people, and everything. I have an attendant. I can have two attendants. And they get me up. They do my cleaning. They help me with everything in my apartment. Mm. And I'm able to go out and travel and talk, advocate for those that can. Mm. So, perfect example, when you're on disability and Social Security disability, you're not making that much. So I do have a voucher. So all we want is to be able to live in the community and be allowed to live just like every other person in America.
Yeah, no, well, I think that that is not too small to ask at all, really, in any way, shape, or form. And you guys are doing a fantastic job in terms of your advocacy. And one thing, and we'll try to mention this on the show tomorrow. Sorry, we're running out of time here, too. The repeal of the ACA and the Medicaid cuts are going to have a big, big impact. So definitely listen to the show tomorrow. We're going to try to do more about that. But just go to the ADAPT website. That's ADAPT. Learn about what they're doing. Advocate. Find a way to help them and support them. Fantastic stuff. That is going to do it for our show here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.